Hello and welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast series brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. My name is Saiduddin Faridi. I'm a research analyst at ISAS, and I will be your host for today's episode on the unfolding economic and political situation in Pakistan. Pakistan is witnessing political instability and polarization ahead of a contentious general election in October this year. Imran Khan, following his ouster as Prime Minister last year, is leading a popular opposition movement across Pakistan against the incumbent Shahbaz Sharif government. There have been major rallies and clashes with security forces in this process. The contention has also continued in the country's Supreme Court, where a verdict is awaited on the fate of provincial elections in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, which the government has tried to move from April to October this year, so that they are held simultaneously with the general election. While the political situation unfolds, the economic situation in the country has been on the brink of default. Foreign reserves dropped to dangerously low levels, an energy crisis ensued, and Pakistan was back in conversation with foreign lenders for bailouts. This goes on while Pakistan recovers from the devastating floods of last year, which left a third of the country underwater. With this backdrop, today we will discuss some structural aspects of the Pakistan polity that have led to the emergence of these situations. We have with us Dr. Imran Ahmed, research fellow at ISAS NUS. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Imran.
Thank you so much, Saeed.
The nature of confrontation being witnessed between Imran Khan's PTI and the ruling dispensation seems unprecedented for Pakistan's politics. How do you foresee the situation evolving with the provincial elections and the general election scheduled for later this year?
That's a really great question, Saeed. And I must say it's one that's difficult to entertain. You know, the twists and turns of Pakistan's politics is something that's always shifting, changing, and big surprises are never far off. Right. And the pace of Pakistani politics is also something, as observers, you and I, is something to contend with. Events and crises quickly emerge. They dissipate only for the next sort of new crisis or next issue to unfold. So you're certainly right about what you mentioned in your introduction, that the unfolding of current events, at least, is quite extraordinarily unprecedented. And I think, you know, I'm talking here about the showdown between Imran Khan, the Sharif-led coalition, and, let's not forget the military security establishment. So it's really an evolving, unfolding situation. But to go back to your point about the unprecedented nature of the crisis. So, you know, I just want to take a little step back. Imran Khan's victory in the 2018 elections, for starters, I think was really the beginning of something quite unique, right? For one thing, his victory there was really a departure from the rotating dynastical parties, which have traditionally dominated Pakistan's at least recent political history. The exception, of course, is the period of General Musharraf's rule. Now, on the one hand, Khan's election follows what many commentators, you know, have already said is sort of the emergence of a hybrid system of shared government between sort of the military and, and its civilian partner. And in this instance, it's, you know, it was Khan's PTI. The precise arrangement of this relationship is something important, I think. And it's something that scholars have often differed on. But most are in agreement that, you know, within this relationship, it was the armed forces that was at the front and center of this operation. So on the other hand, with this hybrid system, while this development itself is not a new phenomenon, right, but Khan's election really sets in motion kind of a new phase in Pakistani politics, I think, which shows kind of greater public unease, open friction and opposition with the establishment between sort of political elites and military elites, and sort of institutional conflict, right? And here I think is perhaps the departure from the past. And ultimately we witness the establishment as a consequence of these tensions distance itself from Khan. There was also Khan's, you know, anti-US rhetoric, as well as his often poor performance in managing the economy and governance. And it ultimately resulted in a no confidence vote, which removed him from office soon afterwards. But to go back to your original question about what kind of things we can expect, I think the short answer is basically that it's quite, you know, difficult to say. We know that political life in Pakistan is quite unpredictable. It can be quite dangerous. And we've seen an assassination attempt take place, which was, you know, quite a close call for Imran Khan. But perhaps a longer answer to your question is that I think, you know, what we've seen and what we'll perhaps continue to see is Imran Khan looking for ways to return to power, to basically acquire the mandate of the establishment. Now, his push for elections, and that's been going on for some months now, is driven by, I guess, his belief that he's going to win them, right? And there's a lot of data out there to support that, and results in by-elections and polls and surveys, you know, really kind of say that, you know, his popularity is growing. So this demand really suits him. It's also helped by the fact that, you know, his opposition, the current Sharif coalition, is basically kind of like a haphazard coalition, right? It's not always clear what they really stand for. And that's really sort of been a struggle for them, right? It often looks, it sort of emerged out of the PDM, the Pakistan Democratic Movement, where, you know, parties joined, parties left. And it was really about sort of going against, providing a united front against Imran Khan. So even now, I think to this date, it kind of looks like an ensemble of the not Imran Khan party. So it doesn't quite have a real vision of the future, or a real mandate of the future. It's sort of been more about anti-Imran and managing crisis kind of situation. So here I think Imran really excels in having sort of put forward, you know, quite a compelling, evocative narrative through his populism, right? And I would also add here that the scale of the economic crisis, the government has had to make a lot of very, you know, tough choices to slow down the economy. And these, you know, these measures have been adding to their unpopularity. So it's certainly in the interest of the government to have basically, you know, all forms of elections delayed. As you mentioned, the Electoral Commission of Pakistan postponed the Punjab elections to October on the grounds that the country simply can't afford them right now. You know, I think it specifically said security and financial troubles. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that much of the politics in Pakistan right now is taking place outside of the formal channels, right? Outside of parliament, on the streets, on social media, and those kinds of things. So even if we were to have elections, should Imran Khan lose them, and recent history suggests that, you know, he is likely to reject the results and perhaps even question the legitimacy, right, as he's previously done. You know, he contended that the results of the no confidence vote was a work of political engineering by a foreign conspiracy against him. So Khan knows that basically elections alone can't completely resurrect his political career, but he needs the establishment behind him. So I think his strategy has been and will perhaps continue to be one where, you know, he basically tries to steer the establishment towards him by making it too costly for them not to do so. What the military does, I think, is something we'll have to wait and see.
Thank you for that really comprehensive and insightful answer. I think it really sets the stage for the conversation to follow. And I want to come to polarization in Pakistan next. Polarization within society in Pakistan exacerbates the political and economic challenges that the country faces. Why does this lack of consensus building exist in Pakistan's politics? And what are some of the issues around which this polarization is reinforced?
That's a really important point. I think there are a number of issues that sort of evade consensus. Perhaps I can focus on one and connect these with a few others and sort of put together a picture of how they're related. So consensus building on certain issues in Pakistan is really difficult. Something as fundamental as, you know, interpreting the ideology of the state, right? You know, what is the ideology of Pakistan? If it is, if it's squarely Islam, well, you know, what does that mean in practical terms on how the state should operate? You know, how it should govern? What does Islam sort of spell out in terms of rights of citizens and so on, right? Now, if the ideology is Islam and purely Islam, you know, what does it say about the place of minorities? And where does the Sharia come in? You know, and should sort of believers have more rights than others? Are they more Pakistani? If they're Muslim, you know, are some more equal than others? You know, those kinds of questions have really sort of plagued Pakistan's political discourse and constitutional discourse, you know, since independence. And these questions are really quite divisive. You might recall historically, these questions, you know, really stalled, you know, they really divided the Constituent Assembly in the early years of constitution making. And to this day, it's driving protest, it drives militancy, it drives radicalism and extremism. So Islam is this, you know, very deeply divisive issue that tends to divide society. And there's been many attempts to address it, right? There's been many attempts to Islamize the state, to have Islamic social reforms, to reform education. But all of these things have always been contested because, you know, whose Islam should be the state's Islam? And that's a difficult question to answer. And then there's also the question of, you know, where does democracy come in? You know, are things to do with Islam, which, you know, many on the religious right argue, you know, simply aren't negotiable, you know, so what aspects of Islam as a political ideology is democratically negotiable? And if that's the case, you know, is the scope of democratic politics limited to some things and not other things? And those questions, you know, they're difficult to answer. Pakistani legislators and politicians, you know, it's still quite contentious. So we still see in many sort of political conferences and gatherings from major right-wing Islamist parties, putting forward a discourse that argues basically that, you know, Pakistan, the country, the state, its society, you know, it's not Islamic enough, or it's not the right, you know, it's not following the right kind of Islam. It doesn't have the right kind of Islamic leadership. And if, you know, if Pakistanis were simply to address these things, you know, a lot of the problems and troubles that hinders, you know, prosperity and harmony in the country would simply eventually go away, right? So that kind of narrative is very much alive, very much there to this day. Now, the trouble with this discourse, of course, is that it really turns Islam as a faith into something that's really deeply into a political issue. If the belief that Pakistan should be Islamic, then who or what is standing in the way, right? That question comes up. Is it minorities? You know, is it the US? Is it the West? Is it India? You know, who are the fifth columns, the conspirators, you know? Who's corrupting all of this? You know, are they politicians? You know, the current cadre of politicians, are they working for Islam? Are they working for Pakistanis? Or are they self-serving? You know, it kind of feeds also into discourses about, you know, the haves and the have-nots, about questions of prosperity, who are left behind, you know, uneven, unfinished development, and questions about corruption in society, morality in society, about nepotism, especially since Pakistan has such a tremendous youth bulge in its population, but unemployment and social mobility really remains an important issue, right? A sticking point, with the cost of living rising. You know, Pakistan, for many, it's a really tough place to be. And Imran, so the way I want to tie all of these things in is that, you know, and this theme of polarization is that, you know, Khan's populist politics really presses and fixates on these cleavages of religion, of class, of mobility, between the domestic and the international. All of these things, you know, right, about who the enemy, and he really fixates on who the enemies are, right? Who are the enemies of Pakistan? Who are the enemies of Islam? Who are the usurpers and you know, the sellouts, right? You know, he often calls his political opponents Mir Jafars, right, as the historical figure that, you know, sided with the British, you know, basically the British, and you know, betrayed you know, the Mughal Siraj ad-Din Daula in the Battle of Plassey, right? So he calls them traitors. He talks about the foreign invisible hand against him, against, you know, patriotic Pakistanis, about real believers, and he really paints a picture of a world of binaries. He blames his opponents, you know, that they're basically stealing Pakistan's future. And, you know, he really frames his political discourse about, you know, who's standing in the way, who's taking away opportunities. And ordinarily, the army has basically constructed its own image, you know, over many decades as not just the defenders of Pakistan's territorial integrity and its people, it's as a defender of Islam, but also as the state's ideology, right? And Khan is basically putting this narrative and questioning the institution's loyalty and credibility. And what this basically means is that Khan takes these important and sensitive issues, harnesses these grievances and polarizes them. And he's been really successful, extremely successful at doing this. And in many ways, he's not a lot different from the other populists that we see in the contemporary age, right? Like Trump in the US. So I think I'll stop there, Saeed.
Thank you for that really interesting answer. I think I want to come to the judiciary next, and in Pakistan's history, and more so recently, the judiciary has spilled over into political disputes and exerted its influence in shaping politics. How do you see the role of the judiciary in Pakistan as a pillar of democracy from a constitutional perspective?
So that's a really great question and an important one, right? You know, as we're speaking. So the role of the judiciary, you know, at least theoretically, in a democracy is really critically important. In Pakistan, at least the higher judiciary, the Supreme Court, serves both as a constitutional court, so its function is to interpret the constitution, but also as an appellate court or final appeal. And it also has, you know, some sort of powers. And that's something I can touch on a little bit later. And all of these roles sort of intersect in addressing issues of grave, really important political concern. So, and this phenomenon is not just sort of limited to Pakistan. It's something we see all around the world, right? And, you know, scholars have written a great deal about this, about the what they call the judicialization of politics, or the judicialization of megapolitics. But at least from the outset of the creation of Pakistan, the judiciary really serves a very complex function, right? In both the cause for as well as against democracy, but it's never quite a binary. There's sort of a lot of shades of gray in how the judiciary operates. And I think to understand this behavior, we have to take a step back and look at things a little bit historically. So, for example, we recall Pakistan spent, you know, almost three decades under the autocratic rule of, you know, generals. And there are famous cases which justified military intervention and tearing up of the constitution, and there's also cases that basically condemned this activity, right? And historically, courts in Pakistan walk a very fine line between, you know, powerful political actors and use and appropriate a constitutional language to, you know, carve out its own space, its own parameters of function and autonomy. And we've seen that, you know, the courts even done that with using Islam, right? And we've seen that in the 1950s and the 1960s, where despite, you know, authoritarian rule, and years where there was no constitution, the higher judiciary tried to connect sort of democratic norms and values and rights to Islam and Islamic law. And the logic of the judiciary to do this in this time where, you know, you have very limited political activity, if you have elections, you know, they're almost sort of theatrical in a way, is basically to try and put forward a discourse that these norms and these ideas are almost super constitutional, right? So even if the constitution isn't there, these norms should be in place and should at least shape martial law. So we see then that the judiciary sort of really plays this complex role in a time where even democratic politics isn't necessarily functioning in the way that it should. So now in in the present context, you know, the judiciary has an important function in sort of mitigating the political conflicts that are arising. But also they serve a function in the politics itself that's taking place. So there are something like 100 cases right now against Imran Khan, and that number is basically growing. Now you have the Election Commission of Pakistan, you know, it's disqualified him in October last year for basically for holding political office, from holding political office for 5 years, for not declaring gifts that he had received while he was in office. Now, Khan, of course, has rejected this decision and said that, you know, this is basically the political machinations of, you know, his enemies, his opponents, you know, and what that really means is that he's going to strive to use the courts to undo this. But so far, that's been unsuccessful. At the same time, what we see right now is an attempt by the Sharif government to frame the PTI as something more sinister than just a political party, but rather as something like a security threat. You know, and this is probably a strategy to ensure that Khan continues to not qualify for political office. So last month, for instance, we saw the police file charges of terrorism against Khan, right? And this agenda, of course, ultimately finds itself in the courts and politicizes judges in the courts. Now, the government recently passed the Supreme Court Practice and Procedure Bill, and this was basically done to change the way in which the court exercises its suo motu powers that the Constitution gives. So the suo motu powers is basically powers of the court to exercise a motion which allows the court to take up something that it believes is in the public interest. Now, the delay and schedule of the provincial elections is a burning issue that Chief Justice Umar Bandial recently took up. And the conclusion of the suo motu hearings in March was that basically the court ordered the ECP to hold these elections. But when the ECP argued that it has to delay the provincial elections till October, sort of gave rise, as you mentioned in your introduction, to a whole new set of legal issues which Imran Khan's PTA government has petitioned. And I think today, actually, we might hear the verdict on that this afternoon. So the timing of the bill to reform how the court carries out its suo motu functions is seen as quite political. So, you know, it really sort of, because it really is at a time where the court is embroiled on the issue of elections, which will ultimately determine perhaps the fate of the government. And so what you see now is basically both sides accusing the courts of favoring or proxying for the other. And ultimately, the result of this, the long-term result of this, is that it undermines faith in the judicial institution. It weakens its legitimacy. And going back to what I was saying, it means that the judiciary has to carve out a very careful path amidst all of this political tussle going on between sort of the powerful political actors in the country. And I hope that sheds some light on the complexity in which the Supreme Court finds itself in today. So even if courts have constitutionally mandated functions to adjudicate sort of matters of democratic politics and uphold, you know, various democratic constitutional norms and values. This function of the court, however, is limited and shaped by the context of the democratic politics that the court finds itself in Pakistan.
Thank you for walking us through this really complicated dynamic of the judicial interaction with mass politics in Pakistan. Now, I think we'll switch gears a little bit and come to the economic aspect of Pakistan's current issues. So the economic situation unfolding in Pakistan has brought the country close to default. What are some of the internal and external causes of the crisis that Pakistan's economy faces today?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. And I think that's perhaps, you know, probably the most pressing question in the country today. So the economic situation, as you outlined in your introduction, is really worrisome. You know, you mentioned default, and that's never to be taken lightly. But we also have to remember that, you know, these issues have been going on for a really long time. So right now, Pakistan and the IMF are in the process of negotiating a $1.1 billion bailout program, you know, because Pakistan is facing sort of very difficult financial hardships. You have a falling currency, you know, the rupee's falling relative to the US dollar. You have inflation, and, you know, you often hear about a current account deficit, you know, which is basically the equation of money going, currency coming in and currency going out, money coming in, money going out, and a balance between imports and exports, about remittances and investment coming in, and basically money going out to purchase imports and to service foreign debt and all those kinds of things. So all of this, you know, a falling currency, a low exchange rate, basically for the average Pakistani, it severely raises the cost of living, right? Because these things really affect Pakistan's ability to buy the imports that it needs. Foreign exchange reserves is basically used to pay for imports and loans, and a falling currency basically makes these things more expensive to service. And basically what the IMF does is that it conditionally lends money, US dollars, through what they call special drawing rights to countries that face such currency crisis, so that countries on the brink of default or in a state of economic emergency basically has enough money to enough currency to buy the things that it needs. Otherwise, within the country, the depleting supply of those essential items further drives up prices and inflation. You might be familiar with the situation unfolding in Sri Lanka and the $3 billion IMF program that's in the works there. I believe that's confirmed now. But Pakistan is quite a special case, even with its, in comparison to its South Asian counterparts. Now, Pakistan's had 23 such programs in its 75 years as an independent state. To put it in context, India's approached the IMF for, you know, similar programs only about 7 times, and not since 1991. Bangladesh has had at 12. So to give you a picture, Pakistan's economic issues here is quite deep, and the problems are quite long term, and they're quite structural reforms. So we often hear about talks in these negotiations. The IMF is calling for structural reforms, right? So how does this problem happen. So things like a reliance on imports and having small amounts of exports. So Pakistan's economy is basically quite an import-driven economy. It spends a lot on imports and it doesn't earn a lot relatively from the exports that it sells. There's also low levels of public and private savings. So private meaning, individuals as well as corporations, and public here meaning the government. So what that means is there's a lot of borrowing that happens in the economy, and particularly borrowing from international partners. And so underlying this sort of pattern of borrowing and financial practice is basically poor management of money, poor management of finances, and a tendency towards more consumption than savings, and also perhaps various inefficient banking practices. So a host of internal financial practices at both the levels of the government, at both the levels of the private sector, contribute to low savings and growing debt. And the way in which Pakistan has often dealt with this as an issue is basically the propensity to print money to mitigate the problem. But this, of course, has long-term consequences of devaluing the currency. And a reliance on foreign borrowing means that, these issues about finding ways to increase savings don't get addressed. Sort of issues like attracting foreign direct investment gets kicked down the road. But there's also with this particular point, there's also something of a catch-22. To attract more foreign direct investment coming in, the economy requires better financial practices, better protections of property and commercial law, but all of those things require better rule of law and better and more political stability. So to address one requires the other, and so they kind of, those two kind of things often feed into each other, and the problem sort of just gets kicked down the road. Sorry, there was a bit of rambling there, but I hope I kind of surveyed some of the points in your question.
Yes, thank you for that answer. I think that did give us like a comprehensive list of factors that we were looking for. But now that we've spoken about the political and economic aspect, coming to its intersection, how do you think have the political pressures and incentives added to the economic crisis in Pakistan?
So I think the short answer is, in essence, is it limits what the government can do. And I was mentioning to you before that, often these problems are kicked further down the road for the next government or the next election term to deal with. So, for instance, political instability increases the political cost of addressing these issues in the short term. That's going to be really, often going to be really unpopular. Tax reforms, raising prices. You mentioned, there's an energy crisis, and further increasing energy prices. And doing all of those things is going to be, it's going to hurt people more in, at least in the short term, in their pockets. And basically what we've seen the government do recently is that, you know, it's increasing interest rates to try and control inflation by making the cost of borrowing more expensive and trying to slow the economy down. But by slowing the economy down, you know, it impacts things like employment, it impacts things like growth. So at least in the short term, there's going to be, you know, a lot of pain socially and economically for the average Pakistani, for the ordinary Pakistani. So a lot of these things are going to be very unpopular for people already struggling to make ends meet, especially after the devastating floods, where, you know, there's still other people suffering a great deal from the aftermath of the catastrophe that's basically wiped out, you know, their livelihoods, and really affected the agricultural industry, as well as impacted issues of food security. So it's really compounding a lot of these challenges together. But the IMF programs have, you know, they're conditional. They have strict rules, meaning that things need to be done. Reforms need to take place, and reforms need to be in the works one way or another. And the issues in the economy we discussed with your previous question are really quite extensive and profound. So it really requires quite a tremendous overhaul. And that's going to hurt people financially at the very outset. And with elections, you know, around the corner, the stakes are really high. And Imran Khan's narrative is that, you know, the government and all its career politicians are corrupt, you know, they're self-serving, they don't have the interests of the average Pakistani at heart, you know, they live lavish lives and, while everybody else struggles. So Khan is saying, you know, get them out, vote them out. You know, they're making things worse. So the instability, I think, makes it harder and more costly to really tackle and undertake economic reforms, because it ultimately dampens political will, even as there is a lot of political pressure from, you know, Pakistan's international lending partners, as well as domestic pressure to go through with reform. So it makes things a very tight balance. So I think I'll stop there.
I think this comprehensive and intersecting answer is perhaps a good place to conclude our conversation. Thank you so much, Dr. Imran, for your insightful answers and providing us this nuanced perspective on politics in Pakistan.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You were listening to South Asia Chat. You can learn more about our work by visiting us at isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates on our research and publications through social media. You can find us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.